This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
To me, it really gets back into thinking about what's the highest and best use of these materials. The highest best use of organic materials is to turn them back into soil. That's the best way to capture that CO2 and return it back to these biological processes, rather than to have it sit in a landfill and turn it into energy.
Have you ever been to the dump? It's a pretty smelly place. Part of what you're smelling is methane, a powerful greenhouse gas that's created as biodegradable garbage breaks down. A number of studies have found that approximately one-third of all waste entering landfills can be composted instead, and over 90 American cities have responded by initiating curbside composting services. Residents separate out their garden waste and, in some cases, food scraps. The biodegradable garbage is picked up and diverted, maxed out landfills experience relief, and the city has a marketable product in the form of rich compost soil. Everybody wins. Who could possibly be against this? Well, it turns out that some people are. Waste Management Incorporated, the nation's largest waste disposal company and landfill operator, now captures methane from some of its landfills and converts it into energy. While that sounds pretty good too, my guest today on Sea Change Radio is here to explain the complex set of issues that surrounds the question, what's the best use of biodegradable garbage? Jason Mark is both a journalist and a farmer. Listen now as he gives us the dirt on compost. This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm joined now by Jason Mark. He's the editor of the Earth Island Journal, as well as the co-founder of San Francisco's Alemany Farm. Jason, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Glad to be here.
You just wrote a very interesting piece in the autumn edition of the Earth Island Journal called Cash for Trash, and it focuses on waste management's efforts to go against a lot of the progress that's been made in composting. Why don't you first give us a little background on composting, a recent history of composting in this country?
It used to be, and some listeners will remember this, that in the late 80s or before that, we put all of our waste into a single bin, and everything from household items to yard waste, grass clippings, and you know, stuff from your yard would go into the municipal landfill. And in the late 80s and early 90s, there was an awareness that we were having a real landfill crisis. And there all sorts of laws were put into place, many around curbside recycling for paper, glass, and plastics. And then also some 24 states passed laws banning putting yard waste into landfills because a huge amount of our landfills were being taken up by organic materials, stuff that could otherwise be composted or just broken down. There was two big problems with this. One was, again, it was using up this finite landfill space, and it was contributing to landfill overcrowding. And the second one is that when all that material breaks down, it turns into methane, which is a potent greenhouse gas. So these state laws were put into place to say, listen, you can't put your yard clippings or your grass clippings into the one single stream. You got to separate this stuff out, and it's going to go to composting facilities. And these state laws that ban yard waste from going to landfills have been hugely successful. And according to the US EPA, in 1990, we were diverting about 4 million tons of organic materials to away from landfills. And by 2008, 22 million tons of organic matter was being diverted away from landfills. So basically two-thirds of all the yard waste we were creating was being kept out of the waste stream and being composted. And that composting is great because then it turns into all sorts of then downstream businesses, mulching businesses, soil businesses, that stuff. Some of it goes in some states to actually organic farms or vineyards. And so it's been a real success.
In the article, you talk about yard waste and yard clippings. I couldn't help but wonder, does that also include food waste, like we have here in San Francisco?
Yeah, some places like San Francisco or across the Bay, Berkeley, Oakland, have municipal composting systems that are also taking your food waste. No, in most cities, it's mostly, and the state laws really were just addressing yard waste, which really is the great bulk of stuff that we're throwing out. I mean, in some places, grass clippings is a huge amount of the waste that's just going into the landfill and totally unnecessary.
So tell us a little bit about waste management itself and the company and the efforts it's taking to push back on the progress that's been made in the composting arena.
Sure. So Waste Management International, sometimes called WMI, is really the 800-pound gorilla of the industry. It's a $13 billion publicly traded corporation that is the largest garbage hauler and disposal company in the country. They make their revenues by collecting trash and by what's called tipping fees. And so that's the amount of money you pay or any company pays to take waste to the landfill and get rid of it. A funny thing happened with the Great Recession of 2008 was that as economic activity slowed, so did the amount of trash that people were throwing out. I mean, simply less stuff bought equals less stuff to throw out. And for the first time since the U.S. government started keeping such statistics, the amount of material actually going to landfills actually decreased. That's good news for resource conservation, or it's good news for managing finite landfill space, but it's bad news for waste management. And so some people contend, and waste management's critics contend, that one of the reasons why waste management has been lobbying to repeal these state bans on putting yard waste in landfills is to basically maintain profits.
And how can they rationalize the ban? Like, give us an example of how these type of bans may be written into law.
So waste management's argument for repealing the state bans is that in some counties or in some municipalities, there's not good composting infrastructure. And so if there's not good composting infrastructure, better at least to send the waste to a landfill that's got a methane capture system. And that's, again, what happens is, you know, all this waste is put into a big hole. And as it decomposes anaerobically, it's then sending off methane gas, again, which is this potent greenhouse gas. And for waste management, those methane capture systems are actually a twofer in terms of profitability. They make money both from collecting the trash, and then they make money from selling the electricity they're generating from the methane capture. So they make a decent case that they're just trying to give counties and municipalities more flexibility in where they send their waste.
So when waste management talks about giving consumers more choice, why would a consumer really care about what they do with their compost? They want the best thing for the environment, ultimately. And their argument is the best thing for the environment is capturing the methane that we'll produce from filling our landfills with more of this yard waste than we were doing before. And we're not meeting our minimums. So we need to fill that quota with yard waste and other things that are going to get us to that methane threshold. But they're actually eliminating that choice. They're diverting it from one waste stream to another, really.
Waste management, yes, is saying that there's sort of an eco case to be made for turning waste into electricity. And all things being equal, if you've got no other options, then perhaps that's okay. But the US EPA is very clear. The best and highest use of organic materials is to compost them. The one real weakness in waste management's argument is that most of the methane capture systems aren't put in place until 3 to 5 years after the materials go in there. Now, at that point, yes, some of the other organic materials are still breaking down, but at that point, the yard clippings or a lot of the yard waste, that stuff is already broken down. It is already off gas and the methane is already out there. At best, a methane capture system is going to grab 70 to 75% of all the methane coming off the landfill. And most experts put the number closer to 60%. So again, the US EPA is clear the best and highest use of organic materials is to compost them. It's to turn them in. It's really put that carbon back in the soil. That's the best thing you can do with this stuff.
And from a cost-benefit analysis standpoint, isn't it a lot cheaper and easier to create a composting waste stream system than a methane capture system for one's landfill? Wouldn't it be easier and cheaper to create that compost setup as opposed to something which is fairly new technology, this methane capture?
I think it's pretty clear you're going to have more downstream jobs created. A methane capture system is pretty capital intensive. And yes, there's some jobs created with that. And there's certainly some economic activity generated with that of reselling this electricity or selling the electricity after you've generated it. But if you compare that to the kind of operation that's going to have many more people involved with an operation that's going to be composting or, let's say, chipping or creating mulches, I think the overall creation of green jobs are going to be higher in terms of saying that to a composting facility. And again, I think that the environmental case is definitely clear cut. The best and highest use of organic materials is to compost them.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with the editor of Earth Island Journal, Jason Mark. He's also the co-founder of San Francisco's Alemany Farm. Jason, traditionally, landfills have had the greatest impact on communities of color and places which are less desirable to live. The lobbying efforts by waste management as of late have had an interesting twist. Why don't you give our listeners some background on this?
So one thing that's really interesting about this story and why I got turned on about it, I mean, it's a clear example of how corporate interests often undermine the public interests. So as I said, the environmental case is pretty clear cut, demonstrating the environmental benefit of these laws. And waste management has used its corporate monies and its corporate lobbying power to start to repeal laws. And the two clearest cases of those are in Florida and in Georgia. In Florida, where in 2010, Florida was the top, politicians in Florida were the top recipients of waste management political giving. Waste management made more than $200,000 in political donations in Florida in 2010, the year that state's ban on yard waste going to landfill was repealed. And also that year, waste management increased its number of state house lobbyists from 6 to 13. The other state where it's pretty clear that waste management has used its lobbying muscle and political donations to influence votes is in Georgia, where in the mid-aughts, annual averaged giving to Georgia politicians was about $64,000 a year. And then all of a sudden in 2010, it spikes to more than $100,000 a year. So that's a pretty clear case, I think, where you can see a real cause and effect. The company had a clear interest in wanting to repeal these laws, and all of a sudden it starts throwing a lot more cash at politicians. What happened in Georgia that was also interesting, and this was all told to me by the Sierra Club's state house lobbyist, a guy named Mark Woodall, is that waste management also engaged in a pretty novel and creative lobbying of state house officials there in Georgia by not only making direct political contributions to candidates themselves, but also making contributions to candidates' pet charities. And this, according to the Sierra Club's Woodall, was especially effective in moving some of the votes of the state's pretty influential block of African-American legislators who, as you said, in the past, had usually voted against waste management's issues because that they felt that often landfills were sited in poor communities of color. But again, by using some creative lobbying tactics and by making some key political donations, waste management was able to flip a lot of the votes.
Now, the head scratcher for me here, Jason, is that obviously waste management has put a lot of time and money into these efforts, lobbying efforts, and creative solutions to this problem. But it also seems like it could have been avoided altogether if they could have come up with a creative way to tweak their business model, the tipping system. this could all be moot if they could just come up with a better system to evaluate barometers for success in their industry. Talk a little bit more about how tipping works and their current system and how moldable it may be down the road.
Well, no, I think you make a good point. It seems to me that waste management is betting that in the future, methane capture for electricity generation is going to be more lucrative than composting. That might be true. They know their industry better than I do. Again, the environmental case is clear that it's better to take organic materials and turn them back into compost, turn them into soil, turn them into wood chips or mulches, than to essentially, you know, let them decompose in this very kind of primitive fashion, then try to capture the gas, set that gas on fire, and create electricity. So it's a head scratcher to me as well. And I guess, again, my answer is that the company has found it's going to make more money turning trash into electricity than it is turning trash or garbage into soil.
But explain a little bit more in detail, if you can, tipping.
So the company makes its fees in two ways, hauling garbage and disposing of garbage. So in some places, waste management owns the trucks that actually come and gather your trash, your garbage at your curbside or your recyclables, and they take them to a processing center for recyclables or a dump for everything else and dispose of it. So that's one way that they make money, is through hauling. The second way is through disposal. So they own the landfills, which means that if other haulers want to then go and dump things there, they have to pay a fee. So they've got kind of a two-tiered revenue system. And according to this guy named Peter Anderson at the Institute for Competitive Waste Industry, who I talked to for this story, waste management has an interest in keeping landfill capacity tight. They don't want to have a lot of excess landfill capacity, right? Because
that's property that's not being used.
Yeah, it's supply and demand, because then there's plenty of supply to throw out trash. They like keeping landfill capacity tight. And so sending more materials to landfills is a clear interest of theirs. And so, again, according to the company's critics, the reason why they have sought to repeal these bans is that it's sending more waste to the landfills, and that keeps landfill space tight, and it allows them to basically be, you know, a monopoly player in some markets.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Jason Mark. He's the editor of the Earth Island Journal. So, Jason, it seems like waste management is betting its future on what was really an economic downturn. And as we know, economies run in cycles. So what happens if they are successful in implementing these bans and the economy booms again and the amount of trash starts increasing? This could be more than waste management could handle, or is that a problem that they'd like to encounter?
I think waste management's betting that for the foreseeable future, Americans will keep buying a lot of stuff and throwing out a lot of stuff. And they're model for the most part, and yes, they run a number of recycling operations and they run some composting operations as well, but in general their business model continues to be based on the idea that they are going to be hauling and disposing of trash. Waste management's model is based on Americans throwing out stuff and then that company having to haul and dispose of that stuff. A totally different model exists, again, a really positive model here in San Francisco, where we have a company called Recology, for-profit business, and because of the laws put in place by the city and county of San Francisco, Recology now has a different business model, which is really based on creating a closed loop and diverting the waste as much as possible. So actually getting people to not throw out stuff. And when they do throw out stuff, whether it's food scraps, which is basically inevitable, turn that into high-grade quality organic compost, or as much as possible trying to capture things and recycle them, and then reuse them and repurpose them for other uses. So I think, you know, perhaps there is, in this whole, you know, kind of mini controversy, a little bit of a lesson for waste management, which is how can that company think about getting into the business of waste diversion and thinking about, okay, how do you create a business model that's not based on people throwing out stuff forever and ever?
So are the composting business and the methane capture business mutually exclusive? Can a Recology do a successful, can they successfully compost the way they've been doing here in San Francisco, and also do methane capture. And then that brings me to the question, why can't waste management do both?
From my understanding, those two things would not be incompatible. You could, I suppose, be diverting most of your organic wastes, yard trimmings, grass clippings, food scraps, to a composting system, and then still for some items that you are not able to, I don't know, Alex, it's a really great question, because then you wouldn't have any organics in the landfill that'd be breaking down and off-gassing methane. You would mostly just have plastic.
But you're saying that these yard clippings and the thing that waste management's trying to ban from going to the compost is actually not producing that much methane in their current system, because
it's producing a ton of methane. It's that the methane's not captured. It produces quite a great deal of methane, and that's the problem. The methane is being produced in the 3 to 5 years. It's breaking down. That stuff's going in the atmosphere. But the companies, for whatever reasons, the way it's set up, they actually don't get the methane capture system in place until anywhere from the 3rd to the 5th year life of the landfill.
Which is, by that time, it's already degraded.
By that point, it's already degraded and off-gassed.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with the editor of Earth Island Journal, Jason Mark. He's also the co-founder of San Francisco's Alemany Farm. So let's say waste management decides to lobby in California and they are able to overthrow that ban. Would there be any state law that could trump municipalities so that San Francisco would not be able to do their current composting system if the repeal of laws that waste management is pushing for in states like Florida and Georgia, if that gets implemented?
I just want to be very clear. The laws that waste management pushed in Georgia and Florida, and unsuccessfully so far in Michigan, didn't say you can't put organics into a composting system. It just says you don't have to. So it kind of moves the burden of proof.
So that's where they can say, we're just trying to give everyone choice.
Exactly.
But if left to their own devices, for-profit management, waste management companies are going to do the thing that makes them the most money, not necessarily the best thing for the environment.
Exactly. And that's the concern.
You start off your article, it's an excellent piece called Cash for Trash, and it's in this autumn's Earth Island Journal. Jason, you start the article talking about the plight of the Mobro 4000. I remember this, I was in college, and this got pretty big press because it was so absurd. It was one of these anecdotal things saying, see, we have a really screwed up system. First, give us the history of the Mobro 4000 and what lessons came from it.
Yeah, so listeners of a certain age will remember the episode, and I'm a little younger than you, but I remember it for sure as well. It was in 1987, and the city of New York was starting to have some real issues with landfill capacity, especially at the Fresh Kills landfill in Staten Island, which was nearing capacity and has since been closed. And some of the city's trash was going to go down to actually one of the first trash incinerators in North Carolina. They pile this barge full of literally tons of garbage and sail it from New York down to North Carolina. And when it gets to North Carolina, North Carolina officials say, you know what? We actually don't want to take this trash from New York. You can't offload the thing. But nobody else wanted a ship full of garbage. And so this barge literally went up and down the eastern seaboard as far as Belize, looking for some place where it could offload its trash. And as you say, it became emblematic of the time of the crisis of our consumption fuel society, and kind of a really telling anecdote or a telling episode of, or you could even say a parable of sort of the dangers of overconsumption. We've literally got so much trash, we don't know where to put it. And so that episode, which got tons of media attention, I mean, they had like helicopters following the thing as it was flying around, as it was sailing around.
And it was so absurd, right? It was gone for 6 months, and it ended up, when you think about the fuel costs of just floating that waste around the world.
It eventually, that barge ended up having to go back to New York City, where it was incinerated, I believe, in a Bronx or Brooklyn landfill. So that episode helped just catalyze energy around our waste system and really helped push recycling mainstream. I mean, that episode was really crucial to get people in this country thinking about all the stuff we were tossing out. It helped influence the state deposit law here in California, which was already on the books, but went into implementation the following year. And so it was a really crucial episode.
And to be fair, waste management has come a long way, and some of these other companies have really evolved with the reality of climate change crises and the reality of overflowing landfills. How is waste management spinning not just this effort to give customers more choice in terms of going from composting to their methane capturing landfills? Talk about their quote-unquote greening efforts.
Well, yeah, so waste management is rebranded in recent years to make its slogan just be Think Green. Critics will say that the only thing really waste management has in mind when it's thinking green is the bottom line and is profits for this $13 billion publicly traded corporation.
Which could be fine if they're hand in hand. If that profit making also means that they're going to be greener in a clean energy economy, that sounds great, but the reality isn't so simple, right?
I mean, waste management, certainly just as an industry leader, has had to do quite a bit of stuff around curbside recycling and has got recycling centers set up that they manage. And in some states they are a member of the U.S. Composters Association. I think that's what it's called. It's called like U.S. Composters Society or something. So they are a member of that because they are among the bigger composters in the country just by virtue of their size. But again, to me, it really gets back into thinking about what's the highest and best use of these materials. The highest, best use of organic materials, and again, by organic materials, I mean food scraps, grass trimmings, yard waste, is to turn them back into soil. That's the best way to capture that CO2 and to make it be back, and to return it back to these biological processes, rather than to have it sit in a landfill and turn it into energy.
Jason, you're also a farmer and also the co-founder of San Francisco's Alamany Farm. Beyond this piece that you wrote, how does compost impact your daily life and vocation?
Sure. So I co-manage Alamany Farm, which is a 3-acre organic fruit and vegetable garden and orchard right here in San Francisco, located right next to 10 lanes of freeway. And on a small plot of land, we produce about 4 tons or 8,000 pounds of organic fruits and vegetables every year. And a key part of that is soil fertility and is building soil. And the way that we do that is through composting, is through taking the biomass, just the wastes from the garden, combining those with horse manure, building high quality compost, and always putting that organic matter back on the soil. And as we're doing that, one of the things we're doing is we're keeping carbon dioxide into the soil, because you know, when we're doing tillage, when we're digging, say, a garden bed, we're releasing some carbon dioxide. But when we return compost, when we return organic matter, we're helping to keep some of that carbon dioxide in the soil. So, and you know, for this story, I talked with Jack Macy, who is the head of the composting division here in the city of San Francisco. And again, the city's international leader on waste diversion. And he says it's very clear the best use of these materials is to turn them back into soil.
Jason Mark, he's the co-founder of San Francisco's Alamany Farm, as well as the editor of the Earth Island Journal. Jason, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Alex, thank you. It was really great.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Cal Jader, The Meters, and Alex Wise.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. and tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.